Beyond. Beyond 3D. Literally, as far as I'm concerned, for Beyond 3D, this is an absolute treat because we are now going to talk to a person who has done quite a lot of research in the area of a lot of esoteric studies. He has done a lot of work as a Mason, has done a lot of work in revealing what the Masons are about. He has done a lot of work in getting into the symbolism and what goes on in Hollywood and a lot of the movies. So Beyond 3D, we would love to welcome Robert W. Sullivan IV.
Thank you, Matthew, for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here. It's much appreciated. Thank you for the invitation. I'm looking forward to the show.
Thank you, Robert. And I'm here with my cohort, Clint Hamill, and we will get into talking to you and just getting a bit about you, a little bit of a background about you, and then the fascinating work is the only way I can put it. I mean, when I first heard you, I heard you on a show from the United States and what you were talking about, and I was literally riveted because you mentioned things that are near and dear to my heart. You talked about... You explained something about a member of my family that I really didn't know very much about, which I was really fascinated by. And the other thing you did was you got into something Clint and I hold near and dear, and that is the movies. And by doing and explaining the movies in such a way that really got us into it to the point where I wanted to go back and look at those things again and see what other things would be revealed to me. So if you could, Robert, for our listeners, if you could just give us a brief history of yourself and what you've been through. And that's, I know it's extensive, but we're willing to listen, and I just totally appreciate you being here.
My name is Robert Sullivan. I am a Freemason. I'm in Baltimore, Maryland. This journey for both books, really, the first book I published is called The Royal Arch of Enoch, and the journey for that book really began 20 years ago, actually over 20 years ago, when I was an associate student at Oxford University. This would have been back in 1992-93. I did not matriculate at Oxford. I was I just spent my junior year abroad there. But while I was over there, I really got introduced with what you would call the sort of influence of the Hermetic tradition upon material culture and society in general. Things like mysticism, the occult, secret societies, and just how important they were and how influential they were. You know, just things, you know, just going back in time, people like John Dee with Queen Elizabeth, Rasputin with the Tsar, Freemasonry with the United States. And even as a child, you know, I always watched. I was born in 1971, so I grew up watching the old In Search Of shows with Leonard Nimoy. And it was just something that always fascinated and interested me. But at Oxford, it was just, in the United States at college, this was something you were never exposed to. You know, I heard when I got to England, I had names dropped on me that I had never heard before. People like Giordano Bruno or Athanasius Kircher or again, like John Dee. These were names that were all new to me. And you know, you start researching and you find out how tremendously important they are in history, but they've kind of been erased from our history books over here. So, you know, this was something that started over there. And I just began doing research and writing about it and investigating it and reading it. And again, we're in the 1990s right now, so... there was no internet or anything. This was actually, you had to sit down and read a book, you know, things like that. You couldn't digest this in a 10-minute YouTube video. And when I got out of college, I came back to the States and I graduated Gettysburg in 1995. This was before I went to law school, but after I graduated Gettysburg, I actually, the opportunity was presented to me to join a Masonic lodge here in Baltimore, Maryland, mm-hmm. through a friend of my mother and father's, and someone I knew as well. So I took that opportunity, and I became a Blue Lodge Freemason in 1996-97, really 97. And then 2 years later, I joined the Scottish Rite, which is a high-degree body of Freemasonry. The York Rite is the other one. And then I continued to do the research. I continued to do the writing. Make a long story short, in the mid-2000s, with the advent of social media, I created an old MySpace page, and this again, pre-Facebook, pre-Twitter. And I sort of just started doing postings, blog posts, putting up some photo galleries, just the research I'd been doing, just to kind of gauge an interest in this. And this was more the Royal Arch material than anything.
Right.
And it was very popular. I just got a lot of feedback on it. And it was around the same time, around 2005, 2006, I was approached by a friend of mine who was also a Freemason, and he had seen the page and said, you know, this is all great and fine, but rather than just fooling around on social media, why don't you commit yourself to a book? Which was something kind of I had planned anyway, and that's when I really started putting pen to paper, and the Royal Arch of Enoch, The Impact of Masonic Ritual Philosophy and Symbolism, that was my first book, that came out in 2012, and then I published another book about a year ago called Cinema Symbolism, that was sort of a continuation of the final chapter of the Royal Arch. I'm sure we'll get into both books, but that's really just sort of my brief background. I am a Freemason. I'm here in Baltimore, Maryland. I am a lawyer, and the Royal Arch was really a product of 20 years of writing and research. And then after that was done, I took this 20 years of research on things like, you know, Kabbalah, astrology, secret society, mysticism, and I essentially turned it on Hollywood, and out came Cinema Symbolism.
That's fantastic. I'm really glad to hear that it was a 20-year process, because I'm an author as well, and mine was a very long process. And procrastination can set in, but a lot of times what it is, it's the research and basically getting everything down that you really need to know. And so that's greatly appreciated. So all the things you've done now, I've got you by 10 years. I was born in 61, and I can actually say that when I was at university, you are correct. None of the people you just mentioned were ever talked about at all in the United States, or at least in New York. And so I can understand. But for me, and I guess it's the same for you, when they don't talk about something, you really get into it and really want to research it. Why won't you talk about this? What's actually going on? And especially in New York, because Baltimore is the same thing, Philadelphia the same thing. This is where the United States started. This is where the colonies are. And there are a lot of information, there's a lot of information out there that people really need to know about where they're living. I mean, 2/3 of the population of the United States live east of the Mississippi River. Baltimore is an old, ancient city, in my opinion. So is Philadelphia and New York. That's where we started as the United States. And the Masonic aspect of those cities is very, very strong, and a lot of people don't know about it.
Oh, absolutely. I don't disagree with that at all. When you're dealing with the development of the United States, I mean, yes, you have a very, very heavy Masonic influence. This is coming out of the Renaissance, coming into the Enlightenment. Clearly people know the names of George Washington and Benjamin Franklin, the quote-unquote founding fathers. Some of the names that are left out of this equation, especially transforming the United States into a Masonic Republic, which is what I describe in the book, is you have people like DeWitt Clinton, a very important person coming out of New York, former mayor of New York, former governor of New York. He is really one of the quintessential characters in all of this. And again, he is someone who has been completely left out of our history books.
It's very interesting, Robert. It's interesting you just said that name. It's very interesting you just said that name, because my father went to DeWitt Clinton High School.
Oh, yeah, DeWitt Clinton is very important. I mean, some of the names coming out of New York may also be familiar to you. Ezra Ames, mm-hmm. he was a New York miniature portrait artist who did a very famous portrait of George Washington. Ezra Ames was friends with DeWitt Clinton, and he actually crafted a Royal Arch ceremonial when they opened the Erie Canal and basically blessed the Erie Canal with a Masonic ceremony. No one is aware of this. Mm. Basically, it was symbolically transforming the United States westwards expansion into this Masonic Republic. The Livingstons are another one. They are a very big New York family behind all this. And then you get into the architects as well. I mean, these are the actual stone guys, the stonemasons, people like James Hoban, who's behind the White House, the architect of the White House, Benjamin Henry Latrobe, who did the United States Capitol building, Robert Mills of the Washington Monument. I mean, again, names that have just been left out of our history books. Very important characters when it comes to the Masonic architecture and the design of the United States. And it was really with the Royal Arch. I'm a lawyer, and it was really when you begin researching this and you begin you delve into this, it's one of those things where the idea of the United States is a Masonic Republic. The evidence for this is just so overwhelming, and you just really this was one of the things that just fascinated me with all this. It's just connecting the dots. And it's just one thing comes up after another. I mean, and it's one of those things, it's kind of like the movie symbolism. You are well beyond. I mean, a lot of times the critics, when it comes to this stuff with the Masonic architecture, this has always been just dismissed as, oh, it's a coincidence. Oh, it's a coincidence. Believe me, when you start unraveling this and you can see it and you see the design, you are so well beyond the coincidence level. It is definitely intentional, and there is a definite Masonic intelligence behind all this.
Robert, I have a question for you in regards to Masonic ideologies and symbolism that creeps into Hollywood films. When a screenwriter writes a screenplay or writes a film draft and then submits it to a studio, and the studio picks it up, and then the director goes, yes, okay, I wish to make this film, at what point then is the Masonic information injected into the film afterwards, or is it already injected most of the time? You find with your research the Masonic ideologies and symbolism is injected into the script before like a director gets hold of it?
The best way for me to answer this question is it depends on the movie.
Okay.
It differs from each movie.
And studio, would I be right in saying it depends on the studio as well?
It can depend on the studio, but it's really the movie. There's a lot of factors that go into this. Are you dealing with a movie that was based on a book that may have Masonic themes or esoteric themes like the James Bond stories? You may have a movie that is just outwardly Masonic but has veiled Masonic symbolism that is sort of Masonic from start to finish. Think of like the National Treasure movies, you know, which is, you know, that they had like that they have Masonic imagery, but there's really a lot of deeper Masonic themes going on. Clearly, this is either being done by the screenwriters, the producers, or the directors. But then you get into, and not some of it's not necessarily Masonic, but then you get into some of these movies like The Shining with Stephen King, where you have Kubrick taking it over, and he's just really putting in a lot of repetitive symbolism of his own design in this movie to convey to the subconscious mind the reincarnation cycle going on inside the Overlook Hotel. Then you get into, and we were talking about this off air, you get like the Star Wars movies, which is the Campbell monomyth, and this is a driving force behind Lucas. So it can vary from film to film, and, you know, my research has led me to believe that every film is different, and they all have somewhat of a different backstory to them as to how sometimes this material, and it could be also accidental. You know, I've actually documented esoteric themes in films where, in my opinion, the director didn't have a clue about what he was doing, but you'll find it anyway. And this opened the door for me to inject this whole thing with Carl Jung of the collective unconscious. As you know, if it's not intentional, is it just finding its way in there through this collective unconscious mechanism? You know, coming down from Plato, coming down, you know, that certain things are just inherent in our psyche, and as an artistic expression, just turn up in film, whether we want them to or not. Don't get me wrong, this seems to be the minority films of the case. In my opinion, most of this symbolism, if not all of it, is completely intentionally placed. You know, you get into movies like The Matrix, or you know, things like Black Swan, you know, or the Kubrick movie The Shining. This stuff is without question clearly being intentionally placed in these films.
That was fantastic. Thank you.
The truth is the truth, as far as I'm concerned.
That covered everything. Thank you.
So, Robert, back to the Royal Arch of Enoch. Enoch, in and of itself, the Ethiopian aspect of the book and how that got into the European circles and into Freemasonry. Can you talk a teeny bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great question, because this is really the crux of the book, is what you're asking me about right now.
Mm-hmm.
The main thesis of the Royal Arch of Enoch was to present this previously undiscovered historical anomaly, which is that the Book of Enoch, one Enoch, the Ethiopian Enoch, is lost to Western civilization from around the 2nd, 3rd century Common Era up until 1773. There are no books, there are no copies of the Book of Enoch floating around Europe. The last two, it's been speculated that the last two Christian church fathers to have copies of it, or at least portions of it, was Tertullian and Origen. These are very early Christian church fathers. And make a long story short, the Book of Enoch disappears from the history books from Western civilization from around 2nd, 3rd century up until 1773. When a man named James Bruce, a Scottish traveler, returns from Ethiopia with three copies of the Book of Enoch. He keeps one for himself, he gives one to a library in France, and the third, and probably the most important one, he deposits at the Bodleian Library at Oxford University, where, for lack of a better word, it sits in the Bodleian's basement until 1821, when it's finally translated into English. The Royal Arch of Enoch book documents that You have Blue Lodge Freemasonry. This is degrees 1, 2, and 3, officially coming on the history map in 1717. I know Masonic lodges existed before this, you know, as stone cutting guilds, and Masonic lodges existed in Scotland. I do not dispute that. But as an official organization, it comes onto the scene in London in 1717. You have the high degree system coming out of Paris, France, approximately 20 years later in the 1740s, 1750s, and this high degree system, originally called the Rite of Perfection, has this 13th degree, which is probably one of the most important rituals in all of Freemasonry, at least the most important ritual in the high degree bodies, which is called the Royal Arch of Enoch. And it's named after the biblical patriot. And this high-degree ceremonial being developed in 1740s, 1750s, is, and this is the main thesis of the book, is incorporating components of the Ethiopian Book of Enoch. So the hypothesis is that there must have been a copy out there prior to Bruce's returning to Europe with these three copies. Someone out there, whether it was part of a secret library, someone had had access to a copy of the Book of Enoch, because it is clearly, its philosophies and influence and components of it are clearly turning up in this high-degree Masonic ceremonial, again, coming out of Paris, France in the 1740s, 1750s. Then the book further documents the importance of this ritual, the philosophical symbolisms, and how important it is. And really, when you understand it, you know, and you understand how this ritual specifically is being used by these guys like DeWitt Clinton, these high-degree Masons in the United States, to really rely on, you know, rely on the ceremonial teachings of this ritual to really develop and cultivate the United States or America. That's the main thrust of the Royal Arch of Enoch book.
Literally, that's what I think. That's the main thing. Now, for me, the Royal Enoch book holds special meaning. I have my copy that I got at, I think it was the Theosophical Society. So that would be Madame Blavatsky and that mob, basically. Looked at the works as well and incorporated that into their philosophies. And so, yeah, when I read that you did the Royal Arch of Enoch, the name struck, but then when you look at the origins of the book and how it got into Freemasonry, I thought that was quite an interesting point to bring up as well. So thank you for that. As far as the movies are concerned, because you've done extensive research. In the Royal Arch of Enoch, I believe in the last chapter, you started getting into the symbolism in the movies, and that led you to write Cinema Symbolism. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct, Matt. Mm-hmm. When I was writing Royal Arch of Enoch, I was dealing with a lot of, you know, very arcane Masonic, you know, histories, philosophy, symbolism, both of the Blue Lodge and the High Degrees. Then I was dealing with a lot of the Masonic history of the United States, the architecture, Washington, D.C., Baltimore, Maryland, Philadelphia, you know, the Masonic philosophies. When I was finishing up Royal Arch of Enoch, I kind of wanted to bring it up to the 21st century. And it really, you know, I had started seeing this sort of stuff turning up in films. I was familiar with Star Wars, with the Joseph Campbell monomyth. I had seen the Matrix movie. And really the first one I recognized as the Gnostic religion. And then a couple years later in 2000, I think three or four or maybe five, the National Treasure movie came out. And that was really the one where the light bulb went off, because the National Treasure movie, the very first National Treasure movie, is literally the Royal Arch of Enoch ritual. The Masonic ritual documents the recovery of this subterranean Masonic treasure vault beneath the Holy Ground. And, of course, this is what the National Treasure movie is. Mm-hmm. It's the recovery of this hidden subterranean Masonic Knights Templar treasure beneath the Holy Ground, in this case, at Trinity Church in New York. So when I was watching this movie, I'm like, my God. You know, I mean, I know there's some, like, some references to Ben Franklin and Freemasonry and things like that. Mm-hmm. But it completely escaped me that no one was picking up that this movie was a Masonic ritual. You are literally watching a Masonic ritual when you watch the first National Treasure movie. So when I was finishing off Royal Arch, I started picking up on this and started noticing some of these Masonic themes and hidden esoteric themes in movies. The National Treasure we just talked about. Mm-hmm. National Treasure 2 also has it. Da Vinci Code also has it. Being There with Peter Sellers is a solar allegory. The King Arthur legend is another one of these Masonic, quote-unquote, solar allegories. And really the best movie to see that in is Excalibur, which really veils the astrology going on in that movie very well. And then I got to the ninth gate with Johnny Depp, which has some Masonic themes in it, and that deals with Hebrew Kabbalah as well. So when I was finishing up Royal Arch, I finished the book on these Masonic esoteric themes in movies, and this was just a subject that really fascinated me. So I began Cinema Symbolism, and You know, as I was doing Royal Arch, I was noticing this stuff in other movies, and it wasn't necessarily Masonic per se. You know, it could deal with themes of Tarot embodiment and the archetypes and astrology and Kabbalah and mysticism and Gnosticism and numerology and mythology and ancient religion. And this just fascinated me, and you know, I started just dissecting movies that I was dying. You know, the first step is to first identify it, you know, and then when you watch the movie to put it into context. You know, am I dealing with a Masonic movie? Am I dealing with an alchemical movie? Am I dealing with, you know, esoteric themes? Am I dealing with numerology? Am I dealing with Gnosticism? And then once that was diagnosed, you know, again, this was the 20 years I was just turning this on Hollywood, then I could just dissect these movies on these very deep, at least I think I can, on these very deep esoteric levels. I can just tell you and your listeners it takes me multiple viewings of these films to do this properly. I can't do it in a movie theater. I mean, I have to do it at home, you know, with a DVD or Blu-ray, where I can stop the movie, jump around, pause it, watch it over and over again. And I, literally, the Cinema Symbolism book was sort of a continuation of the Royal Arch of Enoch's final chapter. And, yeah, it just broke down more movies, not necessarily on a Masonic level, but just talking about these very arcane themes veiled in popular movies.
Robert, have you had a chance to look at such film franchises as, like, the Divergent series and the Hunger Games?
Yeah, I haven't seen any of the Hunger Games or the Divergent movies, so when I get asked about movies I haven't seen, I just really don't get into it because it's not right that I talk about a movie that I haven't seen. I will say this, that, you know, when it came to this, the movies, you know, you don't have to look at popular movies that are coming out today to find these arcane themes in film, and I would stress also they're not necessarily Masonic per se. Some are. But they, you know, they can deal with, you know, these just very deep esoteric themes. But you can go back in time. You know, some of these movies come out of the 60s, the 70s, the 40s. The Wizard of Oz is overloaded with esoteric iconography. So, you know, you can find it in all generations. And not all movies have it. I've watched films expecting to see a lot, and I've found none. And I've watched movies where I didn't expect to find anything, and then the next thing I know, I've made 10 pages of notes about all the esoteric imagery that I found. So it can go both ways, as it were.
Good to see you keeping your mind open, Robert, with everything that comes your way.
Oh, absolutely. Like I said, one of the motivating factors with writing the Cinema Symbolism book and the Royal Arch was, you know, I, as I was doing this, you start connecting the dots. And you're, the more research you do, the more, you know, your mind you take in. And especially going, you know, I've been asked this before, especially going through the Masonic rituals, I don't think either book would exist if I had not become a Freemason, because those rituals definitely will open your mind up to a line of symbolic thinking. So just doing the research and becoming a Freemason, I mean, I was definitely, at least in my opinion, able to, you know, more easily connect the dots, and definitely the 20 years of researching secret societies and mysticism and the occult, you know, which was a product of the Royal Arch of Enoch, then turning it on Hollywood, you know, it definitely made these movies just much more for me, definitely, you know, much more easier, I guess, than the average person to see some of this esoteric themes and then diagnose the movie. I would also just point out to you and your listeners that I only diagnose or analyze movies that I'm 100% convinced that this material is going on in. If I see something and there's not enough, or, you know, I'm unconvinced, I don't do an analysis. I have to be 100% convinced that these themes and these symbols are definitely present in a movie before I will take it on and start, you know, writing about it.
Robert, back to the Royal Arch of Enoch, and this is something that's near and dear to my heart insofar as a Roman Catholic, we dealt with this a lot. The Jesuits and their role as far as Masonic ritual is concerned. I know you've talked about that and written about that, so can you give us a little excerpt of that?
Oh, absolutely. What you have going on, and let me just, I have to give just a little bit of back history on this.
No problem.
When you have modern-day Freemasonry coming on the scene in 1717 England, Freemasonry at that point in time embraced a political doctrine called Whiggery, which was essentially that that there was going to be no Roman Catholic monarch on the English throne, and that the Parliament was going to craft the laws of England, and Parliament was going to be elected by the people, and that the monarch was essentially a figurehead. That was really the political, you know, culture that Masonry had embraced, you know, in 1717.
Mm-hmm.
You go back in time, you know, with the Roman Catholic Church, and in England, you have, of course, Henry VIII creating the English Church, the Church of England, throwing out the Catholics, throwing out the Vatican, throwing out the Jesuits. And then, of course, after that, you have the Counter-Reformation, which is, you know, the Jesuits essentially being charged with the destruction of the Protestant religion, mainly England, by any means necessary. So you have the Spanish Armada of 1588, a Jesuit operation You have 1605. You have the Guy Fawkes gunpowder plot to blow up James I and the Protestant Parliament. This is, a Jesuit operation. So then you have Freemasonry come on the scene, this sort of non-denominational Christian Protestant secret society that becomes very popular. And where's it coming out of? London, England, the archenemy of the Jesuit. So what you have going on is years later, this Roman Catholic Jacobite Englishman named Andrew Michael the Chevalier Ramsay, he was sympathetic to the Stuarts, and namely the Catholic side of the Stuarts. He writes this oration in 1737 that traces Masonry's history back to this Roman Catholic warrior monk class called the Knights Templar. And it's out of his oration that the high degrees are developed. And they are developed in Paris, France, by this Jesuit college called the College of Clermont. Some Masons disagree with this. If you research this and you take your time, you will realize this is the correct explanation. And you can ask yourself, okay, why would the Jesuits cultivate these high degrees? And the answer is part of the Counter-Reformation. It's a complete operation of the Counter-Reformation. And what the high degrees were is they are, if you look at the Blue Lodge of Masonry, the Blue Lodge is sort of democratic, egalitarian, brotherhood. You get into the high degrees, they definitely embrace things such as papal monarchy, apotheosis, the idea of the candidate becoming godlike, and just these very esoteric Roman Catholic Christian themes that you will find in the high degrees. And again, it's developed by the Jesuits as part of the Counter-Reformation to sort of thwart the Blue Degrees, thwart England. But there was another real secret, more secretive purpose to this, and the answer is it was really designed to be a vehicle to put a Stuart pretender, namely a man named Bonnie Prince Charlie, Charles Edward Stuart, back on the throne in England. So the Society of Jesus develops the high degrees of Freemasonry as a Counter-Reformation ruse, and this is where this high degree ceremonial, the Royal Arch of Enoch, will be found as part of this high degree system. These 25 degrees coming out of Paris, France, cultivated by the Society of Jesus. And the idea of the Jesuits getting their hands on a copy of the Book of Enoch is not only not surprising, it's probably very likely. I can certainly talk about that if you want me to. But no, the Jesuits, you will find some nexuses to the Society of Jesus, especially in the United States when you get into the Blue Lodge, mainly through the family of Daniel Carroll. But when you get into the high degrees, you know, this is definitely a product of the Jesuits, the Counter-Reformation, to sort of infiltrate Blue Lodge Freemasonry and set up these Roman Catholic, quote-unquote, high-degree ceremonial bodies, which become very popular. And they sort of, you know, just I'll wrap up on this, they sort of take on a life of its own. After the threat of Jacobite restoration passes in England, the Jesuits sort of drop out of the scene, but the high degrees survive, they become very popular. And in the United States, they eventually become what's called the Scottish Rite and the York Rite here in the United States of America.
Gotcha. Yeah, well, the Jesuits, they may have dropped out of the scene, but they're still there. And they finally got the papacy. So a lot of things going on there as well. Now, we'll get into what some people would, I guess, call the meat and potatoes of the fact, because you wrote a great book called Cinema Symbolism. And the first movie that you really get into as far as the symbolism is concerned is, and the first movie I could say that I've seen as a kid growing up, would have to be The Wizard of Oz.
Yes, that's a movie that I take on inside Cinema Symbolism. I want to say it's one of the later chapters. It's not the first chapter of the book.
Mm-hmm.
The Wizard of Oz is a fascinating study, probably one of my most favorite chapters to write in Cinema Symbolism. There is a very deep backstory with this. The man who wrote The Wizard of Oz, this is how we know this material is intentional, is the man who wrote The Wizard of Oz was L. Frank Baum.
Mm-hmm.
And L. Frank Baum and his wife was a member of something you mentioned earlier. He was a member of Madame Blavatsky's Theosophy
mm-hmm.
movement,
yep.
Theosophy Society. So within The Wizard of Oz, you really have three levels of symbolism going on. You have one is what you would call your profane explanation. This is just what you would call, you know, your base explanation. When it comes to symbolism, there's always an exoteric and an esoteric. And of course, what The Wizard of Oz is, it's just the story about this little girl who has this magical adventure in this magical land, goes on this journey, meets some strange friends, defeats an evil wish, and returns home at the end, have a nice day.
Mm.
But then you have these two deeper levels of symbolism going on in The Wizard of Oz. One is more known than the other. And the first one is that The Wizard of Oz is sort of a political allegory representing 1895 to around 1905 America. The Wizard of Oz comes out in 1900, the book, and you have these very deep political themes going on where the Wizard of Oz himself is President William McKinley. McKinley wanted to use gold and silver to back paper money. This is why the wizard dwells in Emerald City, representing, you know, green paperback money. The yellow brick road is yellow. It's gold. It's the gold standard that leads to paper money. In the novel, the Dorothy slippers are silver, and this represented the free silver movement, which was also this idea of using silver to back paper money. So she walks on the gold. The silver and the gold lead to the green money. So, you know, you have this political allegory. Then you have the idea of the scarecrow being the American farmer, Tin Man being the American laborer. When they meet Tin Man, he's immobile. This represented the Depression of 1896, which saw many laborers and workers laid off in droves. They were able to return to work through the Rockefeller Standard Oil Company. The oil companies put the laborers back to work. This is why in the movie, Tin Man has to be oiled up to get him moving again. This is representing the American labor going to work for the oil companies. And then you have Cowardly Lion, who was either Eugene Debs or William Jennings Bryan, the two political challengers to President McKinley, who were all bark, no bite, hence it's a Cowardly Lion. So you have this, and then, of course, you get into the movie. You have the two little dancing guilds of the Munchkin. You have the Lollipop League, which is the awakening, which is the unionized labor, which was coming on the scene under McKinley's administration. And then you have the Lullaby League, which is the little female dancers. That's the sleeping yet awakening suffrage movement, the women's suffrage movement, which was also occurring under McKinley. So you have this very deep political allegories going on in The Wizard of Oz. But then you have a third level of symbolism in The Wizard of Oz, and that is what I call in the book this sort of, you know, Madame Blavatsky theosophical initiation into the mystery religion, initiation into Gnosis, Gnostic themes. You have the idea of Dorothy, this farm girl, going up this winding staircase in Freemasonry. This is the winding staircase of the middle chamber, which leads to knowledge. You could call this thing the ladder of Mithras, the ladder of Minerva, Jacob's ladder, which is, of course, the tornado. She goes up this winding staircase to this magical land to receive Gnosis. She walks on the golden path of religion, and part of the idea behind theosophy was that the golden paths of religion, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, lead to a false messiah. Hence, you have the Wizard of Oz, who is a giant ogre. He's a fraud. So you have the idea of the golden paths of religion leading to this false god. This is a major tenet of theosophy. Blavatsky said, in order to receive Gnosis, in order to discover one's true self, you have to have intelligence, you have to have fortitude, and you have to have conviction. And of course, this is why she has the three friends who are seeking a brain, a heart, and courage. Again, this is symbolizing theosophy. And then, you know, Dorothy goes on this magical journey. She walks on the path, you know, the magical path of religion, only to discover a false messiah, the demiurge, in Gnosticism. And then she has her epiphany. You know, she has this adventure. She defeats the evil witch. And then, you know, she uncovers that this thing is a fraud, and that's when she has her epiphany, which for her, there's no place like home. And then she has her divine spark. You know, her divine spark is ignited. She's achieved Gnosis. She's received Gnosis, and then she goes back home. No one understands her adventure. No one, you know, these would be, you know, when she's laying in bed surrounded by the farmhand, you know, these would be your profane masses. No one understands her adventure. No one understands her Gnosis. She's better off because of it. She knows better, but no one else understands it. So you have this very Gnostic theme of initiation into the mysteries in The Wizard of Oz. It's a fascinating study. I get into it much more in depth inside the Cinema Symbolism book. So, you know, if you're interested, check it out there. But The Wizard of Oz is a great study and was probably one of my favorite chapters to write in the book.
Now, what you just described, as you were talking and as you were saying that, from my spiritual understanding, it's almost like a Kundalini awakening as well. Starts at the base of the spine, moves up the so-called ladder, gets to the crown center of the head where enlightenment happens. So that's basically what the story is.
Right. It's, you know, you will find this in other works as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, The Wizard of Oz is one. You will find this paralleled in Alice in Wonderland by Lewis Carroll, where instead of going up, she goes down the rabbit hole, but it's essentially the same thing. She goes to the magical realm to receive Gnosis, and Carol's Alice in Wonderland is same sort of thing, is replete with symbolic characters representing Gnosis. If you want to look at the Jack and the Beanstalk legend, it's the same sort of theme. you know, where the guy goes up, the child goes up the beanstalk, up the magical ladder to find the wondrous land, only to find it being ruled by the ogre, the demiurge. So, you know, you can find these themes in other source material as well. Wizard of Oz is one of them. Another movie that somewhat parallels this, and I talk about it in the book, was a movie by Peter Jackson that came out a few years ago called The Lovely Bones, which is the same sort of thing. The little girl dies and has to navigate purgatory in order to receive gnosis while learning to let go of the material world. These are very Gnostic themes. A lot of deep esoteric symbolism in The Lovely Bones as well, which is a very symbolic movie, which is one I also took on inside the book. So yes, no, I don't disagree with you. You will find these very arcane mystical themes in movies, no question about it.
One thing we have to talk about movie-wise now, because it is the time right now, or at least on I think it's the 21st of October. It'd have to be Back to the Future.
Yeah, that's right. We're coming up on the anniversary of Back to the Future Part 2, where Doc Brown go ahead in the future to October 21st, 2015, where, of all things, the Chicago Cubs win the World Series.
Oh, no way.
Wouldn't that be remarkable if that happened?
No way.
Yeah, I mean, who knows? The Cubs are in it, and I think they're odds-on favorite to win it. So if you remember the movie, the Cubs beat a Florida team, which doesn't exist. But if the Cubs win the World Series, then Back to the Future Part 2 got it correct, all things.
Oh, good point.
I actually read an interview with Bob Gale, who wrote Back to the Future this morning, and he said he picked a team that had absolutely no chance ever of making the World Series on that date, and look what's happened. Art imitating life.
Yeah, it's funny if that should happen.
Surely there's got to be bigger forces at work when you're looking at something like that.
Well, I don't, you know, I mean, my goodness, I mean, you know, when did Back to the Future Part 2 come out? 1989 or something?
85.
So, I mean, that's just obviously, you know, I mean, if that's a lucky guess on that one. But Back to the Future, this was another long study in the book, and I'll try to get into it. It's a very lengthy study, but you are dealing with a ton of Egyptian and numerological symbolism in the Back to the Future trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
There is all kind of esoteric themes going on inside the whole trilogy. Zemeckis and Spielberg love to wreak havoc with you in a lot of themes, with the placement of buildings. Buildings in the past have parallel or contrasting meanings in the future. For example, in Back to the Future Part 1, when it's the Save the Clock Tower, when Marty gets the little flyer, the woman standing in front of a fortune teller shop called the Third Eye, which you obviously go into read your future. When Marty and Doc go ahead to 2015, that same building is Blast to the Past, which is where he gets the Sports Almanac. So in the past, you can see the future. In the future, it houses all the relics of the past. So you have this sort of, you know, idea of going literally back to the future. They also wreak havoc with you at the very, very beginning, Back to the Future. The actual opening of Back to the Future Part 1 is the end of the movie. When they're spanning Doc Brown's clocks, timepieces, you will find the little wino lifting the bottle to his mouth, and this symbolizes Reds, the drunk at the end of the movie when Marty comes back. And then you'll go to another clock piece, time piece, where you'll see the little guy hanging off the clock hand, dressed exactly like Brown is in the future or in the past, which of course represents Brown, you know, hanging off the clock face in 1955. And then you go to Brown's alarm clock, which goes off, and you'll hear something to the effect of October is inventory month at Statler Toyota. The Statler family and the Statler Toyota dealership, that's where Marty gets the car, the 4x4. At the end of the movie, it's from Statler Toyota. When he's actually sitting there with his girlfriend Jennifer, he says, "Check out that 4x4," and you'll see a banner across it saying another 4x4 from Statler Toyota. So the beginning of Back to the Future is actually the ending of the movie on a symbolic level. Literally, you are going back to the future with that. And all three movies play around with this. But you also have this very decidedly Egyptian solar feel to this movie, where you have sort of the Osirian cycle with Marty, his mother and father, and then their archenemy Biff Tannen, who is, of course, the archenemy of the Egyptian solar family, Tannen, Typhon, you know, doing battle with them. You have the solar family living in Lion Estate, Leo the lion, Leo's the sole house of the sun. You have the DeLorean as the sun chariot that Horus or Apollo drive. Horus is comparatively the Egyptian equivalent of the sun god Apollo. And, of course, the DeLorean has to get, you know, can break the space-time continuum at 88 miles per hour. And at the end of Back to the Future, we are told ad nauseum that the lightning's going to strike at 10:04. That's a very esoteric reference to the date of October 4th, which is the 277th day on the Gregorian solar calendar, which means there are 88 sun days left. That's why the car has to be activated with solar energy to get it past the space-time continuum. There's a ton of esoteric symbolism in Back to the Future trilogy. I'm literally, just for time constraints, touching on some of this, but it's a very deep study. I get into it much more in the book. But just the Back to the Future movies are one of those trilogies which I was talking about earlier, where I was really kind of, when you sit down and watch it, you're not really expecting to find anything. But when you start paying attention to these things, these are a trilogy set of movies. This trilogy just is overloaded with esoteric themes and symbolisms. It's really uncanny.
Beyond.
That's it for this episode of Beyond 3D. You will definitely want to tune in next week for part two of the interview with author, lawyer, and Freemason Robert W. Sullivan IV. Until then, keep looking out there. You never know what you'll find.